Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller is an oncologist who specializes in pain and palliative care. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, we take a look at the prevention and treatment of lung cancer with Dr. Frank Detterbach, a professor of thoracic surgery at Yale, along with his colleague, Dr. Lynn Tanui, a professor of pulmonary medicine.
I want to start out with a question about cigarette smoking and lung cancer. Obviously, you know, they're related, but how are they related? I mean, what's the connection? Lynn?
There's no question that cigarette smoking is the major risk factor for lung cancer. The majority of patients who have lung cancer do smoke. In the United States, about 5% of lung cancers in men occur in non-smokers, and in women, about 15%. So smoking is clearly not the only risk factor, but it is obviously the most important one.
I think there are a number of things that are changing, though. Certainly about 50% of people that we diagnose with lung cancer now are former smokers that quit many, many years ago. And in fact, I think in many ways we've sort of put blinders on and we haven't really focused enough on the family history and history of other cancers and so forth that predispose people. And we've focused so much on smoking that we've ignored some of those things. And we really are starting to realize that those other factors are also very important and we need to take notice of them.
But Frank, just picking up on that point, if an individual stops smoking, is there a point at which then the risk goes to completely zero, or is there always kind of a baseline risk for developing lung cancer?
Well, that's a common misconception that if you stop smoking, it eventually goes down to as if you had never smoked, and that really doesn't happen. I think that your risk goes down a lot compared to continuing to smoke, but whatever risk you have built up from the period of time that you've smoked, you kind of maintain that risk. You don't continue to build it up. So you always carry a higher risk than that of someone who never smoked at all.
Having said that, though, there's no question that if you stop smoking, the risk declines. And there are very good studies done in the United States and abroad showing that when you stop smoking, your risk progressively decreases. It is true that it never goes to that of a never smoker, but there's no question that cigarette cessation at any age really is very helpful. So even if you're smoking into your 50s and 60s and you quit, there is benefit. There's benefit to that.
Now, obviously it'd be great if people quit totally, but is there a benefit to cutting down? People will say, oh, I'm going to cut back.
I think you really need to quit.
Okay.
And there are so many good ways now to quit smoking that everybody really should try.
And what about this issue of, you know, secondhand passive smoke? You know, we hear a lot these days in the news, and in particular, you know, could this account for that 15% of women that you mentioned, Lynn, that themselves are not smokers, but is it possible that their husbands, loved ones, family members were big smokers?
That's absolutely true, that environmental tobacco smoke exposure is carcinogenic. It's much less so than people who smoke themselves, but it does contribute to risk, and that is why there are now laws to protect people from passive smoke exposure. But it is probably one of the factors that contributes to the incidence of lung cancer in people who don't directly smoke.
Well, I think that it clearly is a risk factor. There's no question about that. But I think that it is an example of how we have put blinders on and focused so much on smoking that if someone who doesn't actively smoke gets lung cancer, we tend to blame it on secondhand smoke when there are other factors such as family history, prior history of cancer, that have a much higher risk, carry a much higher risk for that individual than if they were exposed to a lot of secondhand smoke in their work and their, you know, as a child, you know, whatever. And we put too much emphasis, I think, on secondhand smoke.
So let me ask you more about that, and let's delve into it so that we're not doing the same thing on this show, just focusing just on smoking. But tell us a little bit about family history. I mean, if someone's had a mother or father with lung cancer, are they at higher risk?
Absolutely. there's about a 400% increased risk, 300 to 400% increased risk of lung cancer if you have a first-degree relative with lung cancer corrected for any secondhand smoke exposure, you know, other exposures like that. It's clearly an independent factor. And just to put it in perspective, if you're exposed to a lot of secondhand smoke, you have about a 40% increased risk of lung cancer. First degree relative, you're talking 300 or 400%. Hmm. So secondhand smoke is real, but other factors are also very real and I think are often forgotten.
Now, how about having, you mentioned also having had another cancer. How does, Lynn Frank, how does that relate to the risk of developing lung cancer?
Another cancer clearly identifies patients who are at higher risk. What kind of cancer also matters. So people who have had cancers of the throat, of the head and neck, we certainly appreciate that they are specifically at higher risk for development of lung cancer. There are some, you know, going back to the family history, there are some families who clearly have cancer risk, that there are multiple cancers in single families. And it points out that the genetic piece of cancer risk is something we don't understand really well for lung cancer and many other tumors. All of those things are very important part of assessing an individual patient's risk to develop lung cancer.
So, Lynn or Frank, you know, in colon cancer, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, there have been genes, specific genes identified as for causation for those particular cancers. Has any such gene been identified as of yet for lung cancer, or is that still a very active area of research?
Well, it's an active area of research, but there's data that the BRCA gene that is associated with breast cancer actually also is a risk factor for lung cancer, for example. So I think that there's probably a lot of common themes that we probably also need to pay more attention to.
Mm-hmm. Any prevention strategies? I mean, obviously quitting smoking, but any medicines work, vitamins, if someone, you know, were to ask you, hey, doc, should I take vitamin A or vitamin E? Do those make a difference to prevent lung cancer?
You know, there is a lot of interest in what's called chemo prevention. Are there medicines or vitamins or herbal things you can take to diminish your risk? And the unfortunate answer is we don't know of any. And there has been several large trials looking specifically at one vitamin that was thought to be preventive against lung cancer, beta-carotene. And unfortunately, those studies, which were very large, well-done studies about 10 years ago, demonstrated that there was actually harm associated with excessive use of beta-carotene. That was not what was anticipated. Everybody thought that was a slam dunk. Mm-hmm. But it points out that when you disrupt the balance of what is normal intake of any vitamin even, it can actually cause harm. There is a lot of interest in minerals and vitamins, and what I tell my patients is that there are no data right now to support that. And again, I encourage them to eat healthy, balanced diets. You know, do what your mother said to do. That probably still is the best advice. There are some studies that suggest that diets rich in carotene, orange vegetables, for instance, and diets rich in lycopenes, which you can get in tomatoes and ketchup, actually are beneficial. But again, those are dietary studies. Those are not studies done of specific supplementation. So eat your fruits and vegetables is the message.
All right, good message.
And where are we right now in terms of, you know, methods, strategies for early detection, screening of lung cancer?
Well, certainly CT screening has been the thing that has received the most attention, and it's still a very controversial area, and there is, you know, data that suggests that perhaps it does more harm than good. We don't really know the answer to that question because there are a lot of things that we don't really know. But it's pretty clear that just sort of broad-based CT screening is not as simple of an answer as we might have thought years ago. There are a number of things that that are ongoing. I think the way to approach this is that we need to have sort of a multifactorial approach where we first look at risk factors, that smoking, that secondhand smoke, it's family history, it's all these things that we've already discussed, and we pick out certain people that we think are at higher risk. Then we look for markers that they actually harbor a genetic defect, for example, that puts them at higher risk. And then we look for changes in their genetic makeup in their lung that suggests that they are developing a premalignant lesion, and those may be the patients that then need to undergo screening. So it needs to be a multi-tiered approach. You know, we've actually got ongoing projects in a number of areas to try to develop that sort of an approach, you know, in the future, and there are certainly other people working on this as well.
So if there's, I guess, concern or controversy about the role of CT scan screening, you know, what's the role of the good old-fashioned chest X-ray, which I think most people who are listening are more familiar with?
You know, there were very large studies done back in the 70s and 80s looking at chest X-ray as a screening tool for lung cancer. And they, like the studies for CT screening that are more recent, show that you can find early cancers when you do these sorts of screening interventions. The problem, as Frank points out, is that there is potential harm when you mass screen, because you find lots of abnormalities that are completely meaningless but trigger workup that can be invasive. They cause a lot of emotional stress when people are worried about abnormalities that are actually benign. So right now, none of the major societies or the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommend screening by any modality. And I think an individual patient needs to sit down with their physicians. We do this all the time in the thoracic oncology program and assess risk, which right now has to be individualized, you know, as opposed to colon and breast, and you two are experts in colon and breast, where screening modalities are reasonably safe and widely practiced. We just don't have that yet for lung cancer, and it's an area that really merits more research.
And a major point I want to make is that, you know, if you do a CT scan, you will pick up a small nodule in 50 to 75% of people.
You're saying just anyone who goes
just
for
anyone who gets a CT scan. And so, you know, the finding of a small nodule is extremely common, and you pick up a lot of noise, and it is very difficult to sort through that noise and to figure out what is really something you need to chase.
So, Lynn or Frank, just as an example, who might, if you were sitting with a patient now, who might you send on for a screening CT scan? I mean, can you give a typical situation, or would there be no one?
Really, the recommendation is not to screen, because there is clearly so much potential for harm by indiscriminate mass screening. I think if a patient has multiple risk factors, if they have smoked, if they have family history, if there's been an occupational exposure, the more risks they have, the more concern we have then that it's not just a mass screen anymore. It's a focused evaluation. And I see many, many patients where that's what we do in the visit. They come to me with concern about lung cancer, and we talk about what the risks are. And if they really want a screening study, or if I really feel that the risk is so high they need one, we talk before we do the study about the likelihood we will find something, and the likelihood, too, that something will be nothing, but it will merit evaluation.
All right. We'd like to remind you to email your questions to us at yalecanceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information about lung cancer with Dr. Frank Detterbach and Dr. Lynn Tanui from the Yale Cancer Center.
Here in Connecticut, the American Cancer Society estimates that almost 1,000 people will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer every month. The good news is that you can detect it early, and that colorectal cancer is easily treated and highly curable. That means that if you're over the age of 50, you should have regular colonoscopies to screen for this disease. In the case of patients that develop colorectal cancer, there are more options than ever before thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers like the one at Yale to test innovative new treatments for colorectal cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller. I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and our guests, Dr. Frank Detterbach and Dr. Lynn Tanui, discussing the latest in lung cancer diagnosis and treatment.
Before the break, we were actually talking about the various screening early detection methods. And Frank, I know that you've been working very closely with Susan Main and the folks in epidemiology to try to develop some new strategies, new approaches. Maybe you can tell our listeners what you're focusing on.
Well, we have several ongoing projects. So one is to use the data that we have about certain risk factors, but put them all together so that we can apply that to an individual person and actually give some prediction of what the risk is that they're going to develop lung cancer in the next 10 years, and then use that as a basis for, you know, further investigations. We also have some interesting laboratory projects looking at genetic defects that we think are perhaps early markers that would lend themselves to just a blood test, perhaps, to identify, you know, genetic changes that lead to lung cancer. We have a number of ongoing projects like that.
I'd like to spend some time now talking about treatment. Lynn, Frank also, I mean, how's the outlook now for a patient diagnosed with lung cancer as opposed to, you know, 20 years ago when we were all starting our training?
I think that in general, the outlook is better. There are so many more treatment options for patients at really all stages. Clearly, patients who are diagnosed with early stage do better than people who are diagnosed with advanced stage. That's true for most cancers. But I think the message should be that there are many, many more options for all patients with lung cancer, early or late, than there were years ago.
Well, let me just follow up on that. So, you know, I'm, as a surgeon, early stage lung cancer, we tend to treat with surgery. There are a lot of options there, so we do a lot of minimally invasive resections with a video camera and very small incisions. In fact, the majority of lung cancer operations that we do are minimally invasive at the Yale Cancer Center. There are other treatments that are sometimes appropriate, taking out less than a lobe. You know, the traditional treatment is to take out a part of that lung, the lobe of the lung that the tumor is in, but there are certain situations that are, you know, well treated by doing a sublobar resection. And then there are some other treatment options that I think are very exciting that don't involve surgery at all. Radiofrequency ablation is one, and stereotactic radiosurgery is another, both of which are treatments that we have available at the Yale Cancer Center. We don't know quite as much about those treatments, and so I think we need to be a little bit careful to just jump to saying this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, mm-hmm. but it certainly is appropriate for some people, and there's a broad spectrum of options.
Frank, what would be the situations, the conditions in which you'd think about these new kind of non-invasive surgical approaches?
Well, I think there are two main points there. So one is there are people that have limited reserve in their lungs, and they're really not going to be a candidate for a traditional approach. And you need to think of some sort of alternative. And so in those people, these are very good alternative options. The other aspect is that I think that lung cancer is really a spectrum. We've tended to view lung cancer as black and white. You know, it's either lung cancer and it's bad, or it's benign disease and that's good. And in fact, there's a spectrum of lung cancers that have different levels of aggressiveness, of growth, and that's something that we don't fully understand, but we're getting better at understanding which ones are less likely to actually spread and probably more amenable to a very localized therapy like stereotactic body radiosurgery or radiofrequency ablation.
And when one's thinking about perhaps, you know, doing surgery on a patient with newly diagnosed lung cancer, you know, what are the diagnostic evaluations that need to be done before surgery is considered to make sure that, in fact, the cancer really is just limited to the lung and not perhaps spread to other parts of the body?
Well, this is, you know, what you're bringing up really is... that the evaluation of an individual patient is one that requires the input of many different physicians. And so at the thoracic oncology program, that is what we do. So for patients who have very early stage disease, and we think that they're an operative candidate and their tumor can be removed surgically, that typically requires collaboration between Frank and myself, where we will decide if the pulmonary function is adequate and what the medical situation is and whether it will allow anesthesia and surgery. For patients like that, often the evaluation is quite minimal, maybe just a CT scan, and there would be no need for further evaluation, non-invasive or invasive. But for patients where we are considering stereotactic radiosurgery because of limitation of lung function or medical limitations, we need our radiation oncology colleague who is sitting at the table with us. And so many more patients now really are offered multimodality therapy, which is a combination of surgery, radiation therapy, and medical treatment, chemotherapy or biologic therapy, that it really requires a team to make these assessments about what the appropriate evaluation and treatments are.
You know, I have to say, it was fascinating a couple minutes ago, you mentioned patient, you know, that lung cancer is not all one disease, that there's different types. So let me pose a different scenario. The patient who has, let's say, not early stage, but more advanced, a large tumor or lymph nodes are involved. How are the team members involved? Who's involved? What treatments are involved to shrink that tumor and perhaps allow that patient to have surgery?
Well, I think one of the hallmarks of how we practice and how we think things should be done is that it takes a team. And so really every patient that comes into the Yale Cancer Center top program, thoracic oncology program, they may not see all members of the team, but there is a team discussion of the scans, what other tests are needed, what treatments are going to be most appropriate, how do we optimize that? And I think there are really a number of things that accomplishes. I think that we streamline the approach by minimizing tests that they don't actually need. You know, at the same time, we try to anticipate what tests that they do need so that we can get those done the same day and minimize the number of visits back and forth and the amount of time it takes to get to a final diagnosis. I think that we are much more accurate at figuring out what the actual stage is. And then I think that we can optimize a treatment plan by having multiple people weigh in on it. You know, and to put it in other terms, if you've got a hammer, you think everything looks like a nail. Mm-hmm. And by having, you know, the person that's got the screw gun and the person with a hammer and the person with a glue all there together, you're really not limited by that. You put your best efforts together. And I think that's what really makes the difference.
So, you know, your group has gotten together. You've sort of talked about an individual patient. And I want to go back to this issue of someone with more advanced disease. Lynn, maybe an example. I mean, what might you do for that patient with stage 3 disease, for example?
So, you know, we meet at Tumor Board twice weekly to discuss these cases, and it is very important for patients with advanced disease where surgery is not going to be an option in many cases, that there be a discussion between all the people who might be involved in the treatment. We look at the pathology, we look at the stage, and we decide what the clinical stage is. And the clinical stage really defines what the treatment options are. And we will discuss at that point multimodality therapy for many patients, chemotherapy plus or minus biologic therapy and radiation therapy with the medical oncologist and the radiation oncologist, you know, in the room. And we will also talk about whether there are advanced treatments available, meaning clinical trials. You know, is there a trial looking at a new treatment that the patient might be eligible for? And the criteria for eligibility for many of those trials needs to be discussed because not all patients will qualify.
It's one of the really exciting advances in the treatment of lung cancer has been the development of these targeted therapies, biologic agents. Perhaps, Frank or Lynn, you could let our listeners know, you know, where things are these days with respect to this use of targeted therapies in lung cancer.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that I'm particularly excited about are that for people with lymph nodes, as you just mentioned, Ken, you know, it used to be thought that if you can't do surgery, you don't have much hope, and that clearly is not true. We can cure many patients without surgery with chemotherapy and radiation. And then the other thing that I think is changing quite dramatically as well is, you know, it used to be with advanced lung cancer, you really didn't have a whole lot you could do. And that has changed a lot over the last 10, 15 years, where we have first line, second line, third line chemotherapy. We have targeted agents. And we see things now that we never used to see. We see people that are many years out from having advanced stage lung cancer. And I think we're entering an era where at least some patients, we can perhaps not cure advanced stage lung cancer, but we can manage it as a chronic disease, you know, as many other types of cancer have been, you know, transformed, so that it's something that you can live with good quality of life, and it can be managed over time.
And there are now some oral pills that actually patients can take to kind of help kind of transform this disease into a chronic illness, as you say, Frank.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, one of the exciting things, I think, is targeted therapy, as you mentioned, where if you understand what the genetic defect is in that cell that drives it, and you have a very focused intervention against that, which is a pill you take, it has very few side effects. It can dramatically keep that disease in check for many, many, many years.
Our time is running short, but can you tell us a little bit about some of the clinical trials that are available for patients here at Yale?
There are clinical trials available for nearly every stage of lung cancer, particularly actually for the advanced stage, where there is so much interest in prolonging life with quality. Again, the specific criteria for entering a clinical trial needs to be discussed with the physicians at the thoracic oncology program. They are based on stage and to some extent on identifying appropriate targets for treatment, but there are a number of clinical trials open at the present time. And if there are people out there who are interested in those trials, they should feel free to contact us.
Okay. And one other question that we have, there's a conference coming up November 10th. It's called Frankly Speaking About Lung Cancer. Now, a quick question, Frank, does that have anything to do with your name?
No, it doesn't.
All right. Who's that conference for?
So the Frankly Speaking Conference is really for patients and their families and interested persons. And last year we had a smattering of all of those things. We had people who came who were just interested, but it is a multidisciplinary program designed to provide education and information about lung cancer for anyone who's interested.
And this year in particular, we wanted to focus on a number of the ongoing developments and research that is changing the face of lung cancer, both from diagnosis to treatment.
And so for those who are listening out there and who are interested in going to this symposium, Frankly Speaking About Lung Cancer, November 10th, you can go to the YaleCancerCenter.org website for more information.
I want to thank Dr. Frank Detterbeck and Dr. Lynn Tanui for joining us on the Yale Cancer Center Answers.
Until next week, this is Dr. Ed Chu.
And Dr. Ken Miller.
From the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to YaleCancerCenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, we examine new developments in the prevention and treatment of breast cancer.